Welcome to another episode of Gangland Wire Crime Stories. And now, here's your host, Gary Jenkins.
Thanks, Aaron. Welcome back, everybody, for this second episode in this thrilling true crime story about the gang that couldn't detonate a bomb right. This is your host, Gary Jenkins, ex-cop, now lawyer, filmmaker, and app developer of all things, and soon to be podcast maker. Well, I'm in the process of becoming a podcast maker. We're sitting here in the dark confines of Studio 4, the home of the Big Dumb Fun Show. My friend Aaron Gnerk, who just introduced me. Say hello, Aaron.
Hello, Aaron.
I hear local musicians and other independent musicians from all over the United States and keep up with the independent film scene, visit the www.bigdumbfunshow.com and listen. Aaron has some fun stuff. Well, and you can find out more about me at ganglandwire.com. Just Google Gangland Wire and you'll find me. I've got a blog. I've got this Gangland Wire movie I made about the mafia in Kansas City. You can buy it there and read my blog and see some of the interesting comments that people make. I've got some local family members of mob people that are not very happy with me and some other kind of cryptic comments by people who are obviously still kind of involved in the scene. They tell me stuff that I didn't know before. Well, Aaron, you know, we left off with Nick Civella and the La Cosa Nostra crime family boss in Kansas City, and he's engaged in a kind of an undercover secret war with a man named Carl Sparrow and some mob associates or some associates of Carl Sparrow's that he's recruited to be part of his mob. Carl Sparrow and his brothers Joe and Mike are kind of the Young Turks of the mob scene in Kansas City, and they want to move up and take over from the old-timers, and that would be Nick Civella and his brother Cork Civella and his underboss Tuffy DeLuna. They also want to avenge the death of their oldest brother, Nick Sparrow. Nick Sparrow was killed in a gangland hit a few years before, and it was probably by Nick Civella or Tuffy DeLuna or somebody that they ordered to do it.
Shot in the back of the head.
Shot in the back of the head and left in the trunk of his car up north of the river. A typical mob hit, as we say. Carl Sparrow's been going out recruiting these Peckerwoods, even non-Italians and other half-Italians, and people could never be be a made member of the mafia, and they're putting them into his organization. And he's claiming they're going to take over the sportsbook gambling and stolen property fencing locations from the Civellas. And, you know, most law enforcement with any knowledge of the local mob would laugh at this bold move by Carl Sparrow. And actually, he had no concept of what it would require to really control these two areas of criminal endeavor. And in retrospect, I think he knew that. I think he was just using that claim to make it more attractive for him to recruit people, make him appear bigger and more powerful than what he really was. But...
Well, sportsbook was big business back then.
It was huge. It was huge. But you had to be sophisticated to run a sportsbook, and Carl Sparrow was not sophisticated. He was a burglar. He was a professional burglar and high-end burglar. He had robbed jewelry stores, big-time jewelry stores. He would steal truckloads of clothes off the docks or from hijack a tractor-trailer truck with his connections in the Teamsters Union and fence them through mob locations. But he could no way he could – he didn't have the connections to lay off the overage. Say you had $50,000 bet on the Chiefs and only $25,000 bet on the Oakland Raiders, and you needed to lay off $25,000 to balance the books. Because mob guys don't gamble, they balance the books. They take an equal amount of money on both sides, and then the losers pay a 10% vig, and that's how they make
back
their
to
money.
The mob.
Back to the mob and to the bookie, and the bookie pays the mob guy that controls him. Carl Sparrow was not near sophisticated enough to operate that kind of an operation, but having said all that, he had started down that path. He had had one of his associates, he got out of jail, a guy named called the Arab, and he'd robbed Al Brandemeyer. The Civellas had kind of struck back and kidnapped and tortured and killed a Sparrow associate named Johnny Brocato. And Brocato probably had told him everything that was going on, and it was getting into open warfare. And it was so open, they were having discussions about it. Now, I obtained a lot of tapes from the investigation of the mob over the years, but this is a tape I had the transcript, but I didn't get the tape. It got thrown away somehow. And it was from a hidden microphone. Let's see, let's have Bill Owsley, FBI agent, retired Bill Owsley. I interviewed him. He can tell you a little bit about this conversation, and then I'm going to fill you in on the rest of it. And
so you only have, you have an excerpt from this?
I have an excerpt from this. We got that, Aaron? It's called
the initial
Owsley
discussion
Spiro
plot. Took place before the visitors came between Nick Civella and his brother Cork. And that entire conversation had to do with how were they going to get and kill Carl Spero. It was a one in a lifetime type of conversations. Apparently an incident had taken place right before this meeting where they noted some Sperros on Independence Avenue viewing into the Villa Capri to see who was around. It was reported by some neighbors to Cork. Cork was discussing it with Nick, and as Nick said, we're going to get crucified. And so they discuss, where is he going? What is he doing? How are we going to get him? They complain about the guys. Their guys are lazy. They're not working hard. They won't sit on places. And it's a very enlightening conversation.
It was a one-in-a-lifetime conversation. I don't know why they didn't keep the tape. Well, I do know now, why.
So the tapes were lost.
The actual tapes were thrown away. And here's why. Because they were never put in as evidence. The only way you can get tapes of mics or telephone taps back from the government once they do them is if they're placed in evidence, and they never were charged with this crime. They never actually killed Carl Spero during this time. Much later something happened, but during this time they never got him killed. Now Carl lived in rural Clay County at the time, about 10 miles north of Kansas City. He had a small 10-acre plot, and that house could be seen from hundreds of yards away. And I'm going to read you just a little bit of the transcript from that exact words from that previously mentioned hidden mic in a house up north of the river. So Nick says, them guys, and he's talking about guys that work for the Civellas, them guys been out to that house. That house is exposed for a mile. You could get a car out there on that road. Do you say crawl and walk? Those guys ain't in that kind of shape. So Cork says, well, wait a minute, Willie's telling me, and he's talking about Willie the Rat Camisano, one of their maid guys. Willie's telling me he could go out there and sit and crawl and hit him from a fucking mile away. I don't see any sense why the guy can't even try. Nick says, well, he'd be moving. He's a moving target. Cork says, well, what's the difference? A fucking deer's moving. Nick says, oh, no, Cork. Deers are standing when they get hit.
Now, that was from a transcript, that they had actually taken transcript from the tapes they recorded, right, them from a conversation they had.
Exactly.
About killing the...
That's the words out of the mouth of the head of the mafia in Kansas City. Anyhow, this is the winter of 77 and 78. One warm night in May of 78, there's a couple of guys I worked with. I was working days that month, and a couple of intelligence guys, Harold Nichols, we called him Nick, and Tommy Joe Walker, and they were cruising over around what we call the North End, and just north and east of downtown, and driving down Admiral Boulevard and looking for mob guys, and that's mainly what our job was. If we didn't have a specific target to follow, we'd just cruise around and see who was where and where they were drinking and who their girlfriends were and what kind of cars they were driving. And
you'd be making notes on all this stuff?
Making notes, who was meeting with who, and then we'd write a report at the end of the evening. And
like if they met with somebody and you didn't know who that person was, would you then try to figure out who that was?
We'd wait and see what kind of car that person got in, hopefully.
And then you could
get the license plate. Or sometimes we'd... Like you'd run the license and we'd have a radio in our car. The radios were in the glove box. We had what we call slick cars. These weren't like, well, you think of Crown Vicks with no lights on it. These were used rental cars is what they were, you know, mid-size
sedan, something four-door, so you could still put someone in the back.
A salesman would drive or something.
But not an off-color Crown Vic that would make you as a cop.
Right, and the radio was hidden in the glove compartment, and so we'd call in a license number, and you'd call it in, and maybe you couldn't get they, it would come back not on file, it would come back to some company. So then you would quickly try to get hold of a district man, a uniform man close by, and get him to stop the car, and then get the guy out and
shake him down
shake
for
him
his
down,
ID,
get his ID, and see who he was. And a couple times we had a guy drinking once, and so we got hold of an officer and we got him to stop the person. And said, just take him on in. He's been drinking a lot. Take him on in for DUI, so we can search his car. Kind of an illegal search. It's kind of a shady deal, but, you know, we were intelligence guys. You're supposed to do something a little bit shady every now and then.
Just, so, but if he was legitimately drinking and they had to take him in, they would leave his car wherever it was at.
Right.
Or pull it to impound.
Right. And so we're just going to park it on the side of the street and waiting on the tow truck, and we got the key, so we go through it. There's nothing in it. But
you never know. Sometimes there was.
Know. Right. It might have been a dead body in the trunk. We didn't know. And he just left talking with one of the biggest bookies in town. And he was mad, and he was crying, and we trying to figure out what was going on with this guy. Never did figure it out. And they get him down to the station and put him on a breathalyzer, and he doesn't register enough to book him for DUI. And we've towed his car. We drive into the station, and the captain's standing there looking at us, glaring at us like, what do you guys got my officers into now? I said, you know, Cap, I'm sorry. We watched him drink. We know he was drinking. I don't know why he didn't flunk the breathalyzer test, but he didn't. So c'est la vie, and he had to go get his car out of impound, and he never was the wiser that we did all that. We set all that up. He was just happy he didn't get arrested
for DUI. Just a rifle
DUI.
Through his car.
Yes. Now, so anyhow, that's a little aside about how we work. And
well, here I'm writing, you're saying the main job of the KCPD intelligence officer is to locate and document the activities of La Cosa Nostra characters.
Correct. That's what we're doing. So that night, Tommy Joe and Nick are driving down Admiral Boulevard, and they go by the Virginia Tavern, where Carl Spiro was hanging out a lot, and his brothers were they'd be there once in a while, and they see Carl talking on a payphone and right by the front door, and they note this, and they're going to continue on over to the Villa Capri, which is only about 10 blocks east of there, and they get about to Prospect, or about where the Villa Capri is, and they hear a call come out that there's shots fired at the Virginia Tavern. So they turn around and head back as fast as they can. And when they get there, Carl Spiro is laying out in the street in a pool of blood. So they jump out.
Right by the payphone.
Well, no, the payphone was up by the front door. He had ran across the street, a four-lane street. Admiral Boulevard's pretty wide. He had ran clear across the street and collapsed over there. He'd been shot as he got across the street. And so they say, Carl, what happened to you? What happened to you? Who did this? And he said, I'm not talking to you. So, you know, they go on. And what had happened was about the time they were driving by there, three masked men armed with a shotgun and two pistols were pulled into the rear parking lot of the Virginia Inn. And they walk in, and Carl and Joseph, or Mike and Joe Spiro, the two brothers, are sitting at a table. At the bar is Carl Spiro's lawyer, and Carl Spiro's up front by the still on the phone. And they walk in, and the guy with the shotgun goes right for Carl Spiro on the phone, and the other two guys go right for the two brothers. The guy with the shotgun, who we learn later is Tuffy DeLuna, comes back in, and they all jump in their car and head east and drop the car about four or five blocks away. And
get, why didn't they finish the job on Joe?
They knew it was time to get out. They had a whole bar full of people, and they didn't know exactly who was in there. It's really dicey to go in a bar full of people and start shooting. There could be
they had never really done that
before,
had
they?
They
had never done that before. That was the first time. Actually, they had done it one other time on Sonny Bowen about 6 months before, and it was a dicey deal then. But see, they knew the Spiros. Normally, as I told you before, they'll get a friend next to you and get you isolated and then kill you. Well, there was such open warfare between the Spiros and the Savellas that there was nobody they could get next to Carl Spiro. So they had to what Bill Owsley called cowboy this shooting. They had to just storm in when they can find him at the bar and shoot him up as best
cowboy,
they can.
Yeah.
Then cowboy, it's called cowboying. and so you know we try to figure out what's going on and Everybody's trying to get their sources and trying to figure out, well, who knew all three brothers were at the tavern? That was the key. Who knew?
Well, the police did.
Well, we or did, the, but
did
we
you
only,
know only
we
that Carl was
Carl,
there?
Actually, we only knew Carl was there.
You didn't have anybody
known
inside.
It for about 5 minutes. Matter of fact, there was a controversy over that. The newspaper story was that we had been following Carl Spiro and we lost him that night, and that's when he got killed.
Which wasn't actually the case.
Which was not true. But we had driven by and seen him just before that, and they picked up on that, some detectives talking about that at the scene, that a couple intelligence guys were saw him down there a few minutes just before it happened. So one of the first suspects was a lawyer, and he denied any responsibility, but he would have known that he was going to meet Carl at the Virginia Tavern because he went down there to meet him.
It was his attorney.
Right, his attorney.
But was he a known attorney in town that worked for...
Yes, he was. He was a man named Danny Matula, and he was a criminal lawyer, and he was Carl's regular lawyer. And there's another man that Carl was talking to on the phone named John Caricio. And Caricio was a Savella confidant. And I don't know, Carl would never say what he was talking to Caricio about, but
that was who he was on the phone with.
We figure Caricio is the one that probably had somebody else there and kept Carl on the phone and probably said, hey, they're down there at the Virginian right now. For sure Carl is.
I've got him on the phone.
They were already set. They had what we call a work car. They already had a stolen car ready somewhere in the immediate vicinity. They already had the guns ready. They just had to get to the car. And what was funny was just a couple weeks before that, the Bureau had been trying to put beepers on their cars, and they wouldn't work, and they were having trouble with it. If that had all worked, they might have been up on them with beepers and would have followed them down to the stolen car. But you know,
if they were not uniformed officers, they may not have stopped them from actually attempting to kill them all.
Oh, yeah, sure. No, I mean, you mean on the way to the uniform? Oh, the two guys driving by?
Yeah, they weren't uniformed.
No, they weren't. That was always a conundrum. We ran into, because we end up following Carl Spiro trying to prevent any other assassination plots. I'll tell you about one of those in just a minute. And that's always a conundrum. Why don't we go ahead and listen to a little interview with Clarence Gibson in there. Let retired Detective Clarence Gibson talk about problems working a mob murder, and then we'll talk about the problems that undercover intelligence guys have when you're in and around these kinds of scenes.
No one would talk. Number one, it's like working a movie scene on Godfather. We'd go down, we'd talk to somebody. Mr. So-and-so, investigating the homicide that occurred at such location. Oh, detective, I wish I could help you. You know, if I knew something, I would tell you. I don't know nothing, you know. Just like watching TV or The Godfather. You know, I don't know. If I knew something, I'd tell you, but I don't know nothing, you know. Well, you know they knew something, and, you know, you knew you weren't going to get anything, but you had to ask just the same, because you never know when somebody may slip and give information. I've worked other homicides done in the mob world. One involved one of the Camisano relatives. We were able to place him 8 hours everywhere he was except for 15 minutes that evening. We couldn't vouch for him, didn't know where he was, and that's when the other guy was murdered. Everybody assumes he did, and he probably did, but you can't prove it because no one, you know, saw him do it, you know.
So it's tough. It's really tough working a mob murder. And, of course, this one was never solved. We know who did it, but it was never solved. There's never enough evidence. And we were talking before, I think, about the lack of forensics that we have today. We recovered that stolen car. I believe they recovered the firearms. I believe they even left them in the car. Mob guys, usually when they do a murder, will throw away the firearms pretty quickly. They'll keep them long enough to get away from the immediate scene and get rid of them. And then they'll change, get rid of those clothes, and they'll get rid of that car. And once you do all that, and if you never tell anybody, you're pretty well home free. You know, Carl Spiro is paralyzed from the waist down, but it does not destroy his spirit. Mike Spiro's dead. Joe's wounded. Carl's in the hospital, and they got a police guard on him, but he quickly asked that it be removed. And
was he more concerned about his life or about the fact that maybe the police officer was listening in on any of his own conversations.
Oh, I think he's just being a gangster. You know, those uniform guys they would put on the door, I mean, they wouldn't worry too much about their conversation. They weren't going to have any really direct conversations about anything anyhow. But I think it's more he's just trying to be a tough guy and say, I don't need protection. I'm a gangster, you know. I don't need protection. Within a month or so, 2 months, he's out. He's got him a Cadillac with hand controls on it. He stayed away from Joe. They still communicated over the phone, and maybe they met at some houses, a house once in a while, but you never saw them together at the same place in public after that, that I knew. But
did they go out in public at all?
No. You hardly saw them in public at all. I mean, well, Carl did, but only under controlled circumstances where he felt safe for a while. And he eventually relaxed and went back into bars a little more. But he and Joe, my point is, he and Joe never got themselves together in the same public place again. And that's, you know, they had all three brothers at the same place. They almost got all three and stopped the whole problem. But
they didn't.
They didn't. And Joe and Carl are plotting revenge.
Yeah, to the degree they did not kill them, it seems like it probably only made the situation worse.
Made it much worse, much worse. Everybody's on guard now. Everybody's getting remote control starters for their cars. They are looking under their cars. They find some beepers that the bureaus put up under the cars.
And you're not just talking about the Spiros. You're talking about
the
Savellas.
Yeah, the Savellas and the Spiros. Everybody's taking extra precautions, looking behind themselves. Constant alertness. Everybody knew they were not safe now. And, you know, during this time, the police department, the FBI, the FBI was getting a lot of information that the Savella faction were going to redouble their efforts to finish this job on Carl. They weren't too worried about Joe, although they should have been, as this story is going to show. But they really wanted to redouble their efforts on Carl. And my job, I was assigned with some agents and some other intelligence guys. We followed Carl from about when he'd get up and get around and about from noon, 1 o'clock in the afternoon. We'd follow him and put him to bed that night for a while. And they had some specific information that Nick Savella was saying, I want this done within a certain period of time.
So you'd follow him around all day long?
We'd follow him around all day long.
And wasn't that dangerous?
Well, that's, you know, it kind of was, and, you know, as we find out. But, you know, they're not going to, as long as they know you're the police, the key is when you're working undercover like this with mob guys is never let them think that you're one of the bad guys. Never let them think you're one of the gangsters. If you get in any kind of a pickle, let them know you're the police real fast, and you have no trouble. If they think you're one of the bad guys, you got trouble. So, but we can't run around in uniforms, and we can't. We're trying to interrupt this, and
you're undercover, really.
We're wearing t-shirts and jeans, or in this case, it was in the winter, so we were wearing, you know, like I'm dressed now almost, and these slick cars, what we call slick cars, and then we even Carl Spiro lived out in the country, and we had a heavy snow that winter, four-wheel drives were not that common. And one of the agents, I remember, he had an old Willys four-wheel drive, and he drove it up, and so we'd have something in case something really bad happened up there, because we knew they knew he lived up there, and we knew they were talking, by this time, we knew they were talking about going up there and maybe shooting him with a high-powered rifle, with a deer rifle from way off.
But you'd have this Willie Jeep.
We had this four-wheel drive
was
Jeep.
Was it kind of obvious?
You like could take off across the country. Well, I mean, you do what you can. You know, you park in you get a neighbor a ways away, and you tell them what's going on, and you park in their driveway, for
and
example.
And use binoculars?
Use binoculars, yeah. It was a tough surveillance. Really tough out in the country. It's easy. It's a piece of cake in the city, but the country is tough. And stay low profile. And we really wanted to catch them is what we wanted to do. But, you know, the exhaust leaked into the passenger compartment of that, like they killed him. And they ended up renting a brand-new Ford Bronco four-wheel drive. And we could kind of sit up on the hill with that and see him leave. And we'd have somebody down on 92 Highway at I-35 and just wait for him. He'd always come down to the ramp on I-35. They just needed to know when he was leaving and needed to know if anybody came up there. So we left the Bronco up there in the country And we'd wait for him when he'd leave, and then we'd follow him down, and he'd go to bars and strip clubs. And if he wanted to lose us, he knew we were back there. I learned later from an informant that he thought it'd be pretty funny to get somebody steal our Bronco, because one night we'd left it out. Well, I don't remember who was driving it.
You just leave it there and walk back to your regular car.
Well, no. We'd drive it out. You know, we just used, but it was the one, because of the snow, it was the one that would go way up to his house and sit down the road a piece and watch. And so, but it would then take off after he'd leave. It wouldn't follow him out because we'd wait for him at 35 and pick him up.
But it was really only one way in and out of the residence he was at.
If he was going to go to Kansas City, he was going to go down to I-35 off of 92 Highway. And so then, you know, pretty soon the Bronco would follow along behind, so it wasn't apparent that he was following him. And so we were down at the Red Apple, which is a strip club over in Kansas, and whoever was in the Bronco, I don't even know if I was working that night, I can't remember, but he went in, they left the Bronco in the parking lot, and they went inside just to see what was going on, and so this guy, who eventually became an informant of mine, was sitting there talking to Carl that night, and he was a professional auto thief, and so Carl said, "Hey, man," he said, "there's a brand-new four-wheel drive Ford Bronco out in the parking lot. Why don't you go steal that? I'll take it off your hands later on." And Carl knew that was our car. This guy didn't. But Carl knew that was our car.
Did he steal it?
No, he didn't steal it. The guy told me, he said, "You know," he said, I smelled a rat. I knew there was something funny about this deal, so I didn't do it. And he didn't know it was a police car until I told him that was our car, because he described it as a brown, two-tone brown Ford Bronco. And there weren't that many of them that winter in parking in the Red Apple parking lot. So you're talking about being dangerous, and like I said, as long as they think you're the police, you're going to be cool. But you never know.
Get in the middle of fire.
And this is always the conundrum when you're doing something like this. And I did more than one of these on where there was a hit going down. You got to figure out, when do you stop it? When do you interrupt it? Nobody can tell you when to interrupt it. You're the only set of eyes and ears, and your senses on the streets are there. And like we had a hitman that would been an informant in with him and was being paid to go do something, and we got to get him to make a commitment to in order to make the case. If he's just driving around, and so when do you stop it? And so in this case, we knew they were trying to kill him. When do you stop it? And we had one really close call on trying to figure out when to stop this. And the Bureau would want us to stop it earlier than us guys on the street did. We wanted the action. We wanted to get in there and catch him dirty, but not let Carl Spiro get killed.
If you caught him in advance of it happening, you may not even have a case.
Right. You got to catch him with the guns and approaching the victim. And guns. You got to have the guns in hand or somewhere close. You got to be able to put them in possession of that gun, and you got to get them headed towards that victim. So when do you stop that? And we were up at the Virginian, and Carl was inside by himself, and we're sitting way back up the street where we're not evident, and we see a guy named Joe Ragusa. We see his car going around the block. We see it make the block about four times.
Circling the block.
So
that's what you call it, making the block?
Circling the block. And I guess that would be my terminology. I don't know if it's police terminology.
Now, when you say making the block, it's because he's scoping it out, making sure it's clear.
Right, and he's making sure it's clear. He's making sure Carl's in there. And he leaves. And we'd called into the FBI office, and they said, "Oh, you got to move in. So we just kind of wait a little bit, and he leaves. So we just sit back. And in the meantime, we find out later that Joe calls Corky on a phone that's tapped. Well, we're not in communication with the wire room, and they don't really know what they're listening to, and they don't know what we're doing on the street. And he tells Corky, says, "You know, he's down to Virginia, and he's all by himself." And Corky says, "Well, did you see any G-cars down there?" They always called the government, the FBI, they called their G-cars or the G. You know, what's the G? Is the G out today? The olden days, I guess they called them G-men, but they just shortened it to the G. So he said, "You see any G-cars?" And Joe says, "No, I didn't see any." And Cork says, "Oh," he said, "if you don't see them, that means they're there somewhere."
But your car wasn't. Was your car considered a G car because you worked for the government?
Sure. No, we would be considered
not FBI.
They, you know, they don't differentiate when you're out there like that. They don't know whether you're local police or FBI.
Easier to spot the FBI when they were in the field.
No, they were just like us. They, you know, they look like us. They dressed like us. They drove the same car. Everybody has this concept. I don't know how many times I laugh at people and they'll say, "Oh yeah, those police, they have those undercover cars. I can spot one of those a mile off." And they're always talking about some tack guy or a detective and his Crown Vic without lights on. Well, you know, you can't. I promise you, you can't unless you know something about the game. And these guys knew something about the game, but you can never look at a car and say, yeah, that's an undercover guy or that's a
But wouldn't after a while, if you're these guys and you're kind of like, this guy, I keep seeing this guy.
Well, that's my next point. That's what I'm getting into exactly now. So we sit back and we see another car make the block or circle the block, and we don't know this car. But when it circles a block that second time, even though Cork's counseled that, you know, you they're probably around there somewhere, turns out they'd come back. And so just out of curiosity, when this one car circles a block a
couple
times. But
it wasn't Joe Raguso.
I think he was driving, but it wasn't his car.
It was a different car.
It was a work car. It was a stolen car.
They call them a work car.
A work car, yeah. It was a car they had stolen to go, and so they were
work in.
They were coming down to do a piece of work, and so we start moving in a little closer to see who this is, and we're getting a little nervous because, you know, if they've come back down a stolen car, they're ready. You know, this is it. And they wouldn't have done anything in Joe Raguse's car, but if they come back, somebody's come back down in a unknown car to us, they're getting ready to do the deal.
So you see it make the block, and you call the car in.
So
it comes back. It says it's stolen.
No, we don't get that far. We start driving in a little closer, and I get down on Admiral Boulevard, and the car comes back by again. You can't control these deals. It's impossible to control it. Only in the TV can they make it work perfectly. So the car comes out, and it comes behind me. And I go up to Paseo about two blocks up the street, and he's still behind me. He's like he's following me. So I take a right and head south, and the car stays behind me. And I catch the light, the next light, and the car's got over in the left lane, and we get down to 12th Street, and he's in the left lane. I'm in the right, and we catch the light. And I stop, and they stop, and I just feel these eyes on me. And I glance over, and there's Tuffy DeLuna just looking at me. You know, and I just look ahead, straight ahead, and I'm trying to get down to the radio saying, hey, the Tuffy's in that car, man, and somebody else said, oh, no shit, and so they're trying to call a uniform car down there to get them stopped.
You're not on the radio sitting next to them at the stoplight, are you?
I've got the mic is down here below out of, you know, you
out
don't raise it up
line.
Like that.
Yeah, you don't,
you just,
like right in
you
front
just
of your
reach
face.
Over and get it and pull it over and just key it and just kind of talk out loud.
And hope he doesn't notice you're like, Tuffy DeLuna.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, I just look over like that and said, hey, you know, this is Tuffy in this car. And they hear that, and they're frantically trying to get on the radio to call a uniform car down because it's really difficult for us. We have to just, like, run them off the side of the road. And we want to get a uniform car down there.
But they haven't done anything yet.
Well, but by now, they've got
a stolen car. Tuffy's there.
Probably a stolen car, and there's three men in it, and the only one I can say for sure is Tuffy. But he sees me. And if Tuffy DeLuna, he's smart enough, if he sees a white guy at 12th and Paseo that just drove by the Virginian in kind of a rental car-looking car, he just knows, you know, his instincts. He may have been born at night, but it wasn't last night. He didn't fall off the turnip truck yesterday, as we say. He knows.
He'd been followed before.
He'd seen many a guy that looked just like me that was 30-some years old and clean cut and was driving a really kind of an ordinary-looking car and was in that neighborhood at 12th and Paseo. It wasn't anything but black people at 12th and Paseo. Anyhow, at that point in time. And so they just take a left, and I go straight because I'm still trying to maintain maybe he doesn't really realize, and maybe we can back off and they'll come back in. We'll have a uniform car ready for him, and we can get him stopped.
Like what you're hoping is he's going to circle back around,
right,
go back to the Virginia Tavern.
They're gone. they're done.
Like they figured they'd been made.
They figured that they'd been made.
And, so they and didn't want. They just kind of called it
they're
off.
They're very careful. That's why they don't get caught, Aaron. That's why they don't get caught. Because if they smell any rat at all, they see anything out of the ordinary, they just call it off. They're gone. They'll come back. They're patient. And so this cat and mouse game will continue with Carl. And what we don't know at the time is the real action is being planned over the phone between Joe Spiro and Carl Spiro, and they have a plan to take out Tuffy DeLuna. So, but it's going to be undone by a very inept character, Brother Joe. Carl keeps hands off and lets Joe take over. And so in the next episode, we will hear about the bungling bombers. And having said all that, tune in to the Big Dumb Fun Show on Monday nights. And for the next month, Aaron will be at Wednesday night at Harlings. Drop by there between 6 and 9. And to see my blog on the Mafia in Kansas City, go to www.ganglandwire.com or just Google Gangland Wire. And you'll see a few cryptic comments from some modern mob kind of aficionados or members. I'm not sure who they are. And some mad relatives that are mad at me. This is Gary Jenkins, and remember, www.ganglandwire.com. Oh, and if you'd like to take a tour of Kansas City mob sites, go to your favorite app store and see the app I developed. Just search for Kansas City Mob Tours.
You can find all the locations in Kansas City that the mob has been at, as far as history knows, including Union Station. Find out where the trap is at, where Nick Savella lived. And if you're really interested and want to learn more, you can buy Gary Jenkins' DVD, Gangland Wire. That's right. Original wiretaps from the mouths of the men that said it. From the River Key through the 70s, it is Gangland Wire to the fall of the Kansas City mob. And there, how would you say, Gary? Because they lost out on all of that cash money coming from the skim in Vegas.
Correct.
If you enjoyed the movie Vegas and you want to learn more about the other side of that story, the side of the story where there were all those men in that back room talking.
Correct. If you remember in the movie Casino, Aaron said Vegas, that was a TV show, the movie Casino. And actually, you'll hear a little clip from that wiretap in the next show. I got that audio from the FBI. The one where it looks like it's in the back of a grocery store, but it's actually in the back of a bar. We'll play that next time, I believe, won't we?
All right.
Yep, we will.
Tune in for another episode of Gangland Wire True Crime.